that defense counsel was suggesting, it would have reached the same conclusion. It would have...
The record tells us that. He gave a lowering of the guideline.
Okay, don't make it worse.
How do we know the court really had given the lowering of the guideline?
Try it again.
We had calculated the criminal history for our...
Well, of course...
It came on, it's coming on slowly.
Ms. Shetty suggested that,
okay,
because there was an intervening arrest, that the offenses were considered related and should be scored together rather than separately.
Today.
And the judge closed it. I agree with you. And in fact, later on, he did note that the defendant's criminal history was not fully represented. And,
Well, the disagreement was inconsistent with the language of the guidelines. The guidelines do require that if there was no intervening arrest, that they had to be treated as one occurrence.
That's correct. I'm not disputing that, but I don't think that the court, I don't think the Ninth Circuit should hold that a district court has to apply the guidelines in such a rigid, ritualistic way.
Well, doesn't the Marquette Authority say the first step is to correctly calculate the guidelines?
And it's the government's position that he did correctly calculate the guidelines range because he had the discretion under application note 3 to do exactly.
Is that your first?
No, I was going to say, if he correctly calculated the guidelines, then you don't need to argue harmless error.
It's an alternative argument, even if this part were fine, that somehow it was a procedural error. In other words, they should have gone to the ritualistic application of the guidelines under 401.2 and then applied the exception. That would still be harmless because the judge ultimately would have applied the exception based on the current reasoning in the record. It needs to be the decision of the
judge. Yes, the judges are very meticulous about this. I mean, in terms of setting forth if they're going to deviate or have an application or apply, they're generally pretty meticulous about setting forth, why they come to
these things. Well, it's not common in the courts when they're applying upward departures to go through a checklist of guidelines and then apply an upward departure in the case. For example, when substantial risk upward departure, a plus 6 for a smuggling of aliens, when there's substantial risk, it's not a common practice for district courts to go through the calculation without applying to plain substantial risk and then find this after doing the calculation.
I was told that a plus six or a plus four or a plus two with the guideline section stated where that came from. You know, it's usually very easy to follow how the district court got to the score. In the criminal history score, it says, here's what we're including, here's what I want to do.
Well, I agree. It's not clear in the record. He didn't cite application number 3. In fact, there was no discussion of 4A1.2 other than what was in the papers of Ms. Shetty. But let me point out on the harmless error issue. One of the points that she argued in the briefs was that there was no notice, that there was a violation of Rule 32, because she didn't know the district court was going to do this. But the fact is that the PSR, in this case, was relied on by the district court, specifically counted these sentences separately. She was on notice that the district court was contemplating doing this. In fact, she filed an objection and requested, she termed it a downward departure, and in a sense the court treated it as a downward departure and said that the criminal history is not overrepresented. But she was on notice that this was before the court. And the court, when the other issue came up, the court stated in the red papers and said, I disagree with you.
Is it fair to say that this sentencing took place when the guidelines were changing and the old guidelines did not require them to be
That's correct. It's certainly possible. I mean, the government's willing to concede that it's possible the government, the court was not aware of the change in the law. But this is the important point, is that under the change in the law, the district court had the discretion to do what it did. It didn't explicitly cite that application note. But I'm not sure that's error when it's clear from the record that the court would have, by its reasoning, by its rejection of the defendant's argument, that would have counted the sentences separately. And so the government's point is that even if you see some sort of procedural error, that they should have, the district court should have gone through this sort of step-by-step process of guidelines, I think it's clear from the record that the court, the district court, was comfortable in treating the sentences separately. and scoring separately, and in giving the defendant a higher criminal history category than was requested by defense.
So what do we do if it looks like the judge may have obtained the result that he wanted, but for the wrong reasons? What do you do in this situation?
Well, I don't think that...
Or maybe it wasn't for the wrong reasons.
It's really not clear.
It's not clear. Even when I read that I disagree, if you go back far enough, what does he disagree with? Does he disagree with the fact the sentence should be lower? Does he disagree with the related sentence? Even that's a little ambiguous.
Well, remand's only appropriate if there's clear error. That's the standard of clear error. Where's the clear error? It's not clear from the record. But there was error.
What would be wrong? I mean, what would be wrong with allowing the district court to explicitly, now that the record has been fleshed out, say what didn't mean in terms of the sentence? What would be behind that?
If this court is uncomfortable with what happened, the United States, if you believe it was there, then the United States is not going to strenuously object to a remand and ask the court to do a do-over. I think it would reach the same result that it reached in this case previously. But let me just point out one thing. The defense in claiming that there was error, that the court should have applied in a more sort of ritualistic, step-by-step manner, the guidelines. The cases cited by the defense are cases where the application of the guidelines was mandatory. Three cases cited, Armstead, Seltan, and Grissom. All three of them involved provisions of the guidelines where the provision was mandatory. For example, in Armstead, the district court under the guidelines was required to give credit for time served on state sentences. And the court in that case didn't do that. The court never went to the step, and the Ninth Circuit said, that's error. In the Seljan case, the district court was required to sentence repeat sex offenders against minors under criminal history category 5, under the guidelines. The government appealed, and the district court said, the district court's failure to follow that provision required remand. This is not a mandatory provision. There's clearly, in the guidelines in this case, discretion for the district court not to apply the mandatory provision. And for that reason, I think remand is not required. And frankly, I think it'd be a waste of time because I think the district court, at least on this record, clearly did not want to treat these sentences as
I don't together. I understand the government's position that the district court has misapplied the 4A1.2A2.
I don't think it's put in the record that he, whether that he knew there was a change in the law. But if it's this court's conclusion.
Okay, I don't know what the government's position is. We have a change in the law. This is the provision. Did these sentences satisfy A2 in the guidelines?
Yes, Your Honor. Because
if you did, then why?
Because it's, the sentences can be treated separately under Application Note 3, which is an exception.
Okay, but before we get to Application Note 3, did you violate A2 but for?
It's not clear from the record. It really is.
But it is clear that the sentences were imposed on the same day and that they were in the same charging instrument.
Well, the first step is to conclude that there was intervening arrest. And in fact, that the defendant in this case was given a notice to appear. And you could argue, I'm not ready to quite go there, but you could argue that getting a summons and notice to appear is a functional equivalent to an arrest. I mean, one of the reasons that this.
The government wants to go argue that one. You may have a lot of consequences in other cases.
Well, one of the reasons that the Sentencing Commission adopted the intervening arrest rule is that...
The point of conflict free counsel is that the district court has the discretion to give an upward departure. And the district court here did not announce that it was giving an upward departure.
That's correct. I mean, the provision, the exception is actually termed an upward departure. I'll note, though, that there is a pending amendment to this exact provision that is going to take out the language of upward departure instead of simply saying multiple sentences. And maybe that's a reflection by the Sentencing Commission that this should be treated as an upward departure. However, in the candidate view, there's also a pending amendment that would clarify the meaning of arrest to not mean a notice to appear. So And I'm not arguing that those appeals have any meaning or not. It's just simply, it's not clear from this record that the court will need to. And under the clear error standard, I think you have to clearly conclude that there clearly was error. And it's not clear from the record that there was. And moreover, I just want to emphasize this point. I don't think that the error in this case was not harmless.
All right.
Or, excuse me, I do believe it's harmless. So.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your time.
You know, I'll just say, as you get started, I'm the district court judge on the panel, and usually when I look to the future and try to envision my case being discussed before three people of this nature, I say something to you, but when any member, either of them, I think looking at the totality of circumstances that this category, whatever, would apply in either event. I'm looking to see if that's what this judge did, and it's not quite clear whether this language meets that criteria. And he says, Well, it's just a little unclear. Maybe that was the judge meant when he said, I'm comfortable that this is before the grain, or it may not. And, you know, as a district court judge, you kind of get used to making these covering comments that I'm not sure is here or not. So, what do you think?
Your Honor, there is an
income
on record that
from
which the judge stated, even if I disagree with your interpretation of the guideline, I would nevertheless impose the same sentence. He simply said he disagrees that the prior offenses should be counted as one where there's an intervening arrest and they've been closed on the same day. Now, speaking to section 4A1.2, it doesn't, the interpretation doesn't depend on the fact that there's a notice to appear in this case. August 8th, Mr. Avalos helped assist a robbery. August 9th, he stole items from a Walmart. On August 4th, he given a notice to appear. August 14th, he's then arrested. So there is no intervening arrest between committing the first offense and the second offense. He wasn't arrested for the robbery before he committed the petty offense. So that's the circumstance here. And the government doesn't really dispute that he falls within 4A1.
Again, those crimes, there's no apparent connection between those two crimes. They're not related.
Well, the guideline doesn't speak
of... I understand, but I just want to make sure we're factual now. There's, you know, they're both occurred at Walmart. There's no apparent connection between those two crimes. They're on an adjacent day, and it's sort of fortuitous for your client that there was not an intervening arrest, and that the state decided to charge him in the same document for both crimes, even though they were unrelated. Had there been an intervening arrest, or had the state decided to charge him with two different documents, we wouldn't be here, would we?
Well, the theory behind the guideline application is that a defendant who commits the second crime after being arrested for the first crime is more culpable and bears more responsibility. So that's the purpose of the guideline. And the guideline does not give discretion.
It wasn't really a question about culpability when helping drive a robber car, right?
Perhaps culpability is the wrong word.
Well, the theory is that, you know, if you've been arrested for something, then try to go out and commit something else. That's just
your likelihood of rehabilitation is going to be lower. And so that's the theory of the
guideline. I do want to make sure that I answered my question, which I didn't get. So if there had been an intervening arrest between these two actions, or if the state decided to charge him in two different documents, for its own convenience, it had decided to do so in two different documents, we would not be here with it.
Sorry, yes, that is correct. But because that's not...
On that issue, but we'd still be arguing the minor role in the 30-month sentence without reading. We haven't talked about the other two things.
But I can submit on those two issues and focus on the criminal history.
Okay.
The judge didn't have discretion to score a Stavros at a point system of 7 rather than 5. And so there is discretion to assign 7 points when he really is 5 points. There is discretion to increase the base to increase the criminal history category. That's not what the judge did. He did reference that. In fact, in sentencing Mr. Avalos, he did reference other sentencing guidelines provisions. He did find the +6 for substantial risk. And he clearly stated it. He did not clearly state any upward departure provision. That's not clear from the record. So a remand is appropriate in this case. And just one final thing, if I could just have a few seconds. The government's logic sort of presupposes that procedural error is irrelevant, because the judge always has discretion to impose upwards and downward departures.
So he said that it's harmless that the same sentence would be imposed if it were remanded.
But that suggests that the end result is the only thing that counts. Procedural error presupposes that despite the court's sentencing discretion, the process matched.
Well, that's the harm that there is, because, I mean, if we were convinced that the judge had said regardless, I would get the same sentence, regardless of whether or not there was a procedure or irregularity, that would be harm that there, that remand would not be warranted.
But that's not the case here. The court imposed a guideline sentence based on the miscalculation of the guideline. In this type of situation, the error can't be harmless.
All right, thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel's cases. Arguments submitted for the Court.